The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly. Inflation is high, the economy is on the verge of tipping back into recession. Enter Ed Bald. Can Labour's new shadow chancellor rebuild his party's reputation on the economy? Or will Ed Miliband regret appointing his former rival? Also this week, going, and not quite gone. Control orders are to be watered down and renamed, but not scrapped completely. We'll hear from Liberty's Shami Chakrabarty. And as he reaches across the political aisle, Barack Obama reaches for the stars. In his State of the Union address, he looked back on a very famous 1950s space race.
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket. You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite. One of the great scientific feats of the age.
Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's commentator Julian Glover, who makes a welcome return to the pod, and out of Westminster and into our office in King's Place for a stint on The Guardian's diary column, we have our old sage Michael White. And way out of London, in David Cameron's own constituency no less, we have Gabby Hinsliff, the former political editor of The Observer, who is now the Queen of the Twitterati. But a warm welcome to you all, and I'm pleased to say that, unlike most people in politics since we last recorded this show, none of you have been tempted to resign this week.
Well, not this week.
Oh, good on you, Gabby. You're sticking the course, are you?
Well, to the end of the weekend, at least.
And the other two look like they might just about stick the course to the end of the programme. So it's been a tough week for everyone, but a tough week for no one more than David Cameron. He's lost a press secretary, he's taken a dressing down from the head of the CBI, Richard Lambert. And to cap it all off, we've learnt that the UK economy has started shrinking again. At Prime Minister's Questions, Ed Miliband had an open goal to kick out.
Mr. Speaker, he has been going round for months saying our economy is out of the danger zone. He told this House only a month ago it is because Britain's economy is out of the danger zone and recovering. Now, can I just ask him to confirm, because he said that if you set aside the bad weather, the figures are not good, that setting aside the bad weather, actually growth was completely flat. There was no growth in the last quarter of 2010. No growth at all.
Exactly what the figures show. Yes, yes. The point I would make. He asks about the danger zone, and the point I'd make is this: Britain is no longer linked with countries like Greece and Ireland and Portugal.
Mike White, has Ed Miliband found his feet for these occasions yet?
He comes and goes. He starts well, and then sometimes he makes a slip. I think it was yesterday. He sort of throws out a rhetorical question, and David Cameron easily bats it back, blames Ed Balls on Gordon Brown, and then says Gordon Brown, which is, of course, always a damaging allegation when you tie people to Gordon Brown. So it's hit and miss. My view is that it doesn't greatly matter at this stage because nobody's listening to the Labour Party until the weather turns badly against the coalition. So what happened on the growth figures, minus 0.5% this week, may have been a tipping point. And as lots of commentators have said, what a great day for Ed Balls to start. That raises a lot of other questions, which I'm sure Julian Glover is about to address.
Well, yes, and we'll come back to Ed Balls in just a moment. But the Conservatives have got their own problems too. Just as Cameron was making his point about being in touch with ordinary people, this happened.
Jacob Rees-Mogg. Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker.
Order. Order. I wish to hear Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Isn't the lesson from the noble Baroness Lady Thatcher that when you've set an economic course, you should stick to it? There is no alternative.
So there's a line of attack, clearly, isn't there, Gillian, for the enemies of the government? The Tories are out of touch, rather posh, and don't really care.
Yes, and he certainly helped fuel that. Various people half with their head in their hand sitting near him. I mean, I remember Jacob Rees-Mogg when I was at Oxford, and I went into the Oxford Union, and he was speaking. And he hasn't changed a bit. And he was just as amusing and caricaturable then as he is now. I don't think he's a bad MP, actually, but he isn't really what the Tories wanted straight after David Cameron. However, the country won't have seen it, and it cheered everybody up in the Commons. No disaster.
He's a clone of his dad, William Rees-Mogg, former editor of The Times and attacker of public services, although he's done pretty well with various quangos down the long years. Old Bill, as nobody calls him. And, of course, his sister, Annunciata, is the woman whom David Cameron is said to have said, why don't you stop calling yourself, standing for Parliament, Annunciata Rees-Mogg, and call yourself Nancy Mogg, which was one of the best jokes of the election.
Yes, it was a joke, and it got reported.
Everybody needs really more Rees-Moggs in Parliament.
Yep.
Gabby, do you think, you know, there was obviously lots of shuffling around in terms of, before we got Ed Balls as Chancellor, he was almost Chancellor once under Gordon Brown. He didn't become Shadow Chancellor when Ed Miliband became Labour leader. This time, do you think it's fair to say that there was no alternative in that sense, at least?
There's always an alternative if you need one badly enough. Unfortunately, the best alternative was Mrs. Ed Balls this time round, which doesn't exactly sort of take Ed Miliband a million light years from the Ed Balls problem. And I think he's done the right thing in that he's put a round peg in a round hole. It's clear that Ed is an extremely strong performer in opposition. It suits his, some would say, slightly aggressive nature. It's clear that he has the kind of reputation for economic, at least economic authority, that Alan Johnson sadly lacked. I mean, you can imagine, had it been Alan Johnson this week, all the questions about the growth figures wouldn't have been about the growth figures at all. They would have been tricksy ones designed to trip Alan Johnson up and make him look like he didn't know what he was talking about. So at least they've dealt with that problem. Of course, they've just created the new problem, which is you now have a stronger shadow chancellor. Is he too strong a shadow chancellor?
Yes, I mean, a sign of the slightly odd relationship between them. They're testing the relationship. Is that at Shadow Cabinet, Ed Miliband made a joke about Ed Balls, and there was a sort of pause around the table to see whether Ed Balls would smile or not, and apparently he did.
Or anyone else would dare laugh.
Yeah, but it's very telling that there's a sort of 30-second chill, just to check out whether he's changed. And people say he's more human, he's more friendly, he's relaxed into the kind of role he's got. We'll see. He clearly had to have the post with Alan Johnson leaving.
I agree with that. I'm terrified to hear about the Shadow Cabinet joke because of Gordon Brown in Shadow Cabinet and Cabinet would sit there reading his papers and not listening to anybody, not even to Tony Blair. I mean, interpersonal skills of a rodent. And to hear that Ed is replicating that as well as everything else is terrifying. I was startled on Friday morning when I heard he'd given it to Ed Balls. I agree with Gabby that only Mrs. Balls was the alternative, but the more I think of it, the more I'm reinforced in the three immediate reactions I had, and the more I listen to other people. Ed's got the record of being Gordon's right-hand man. Some say Ed was the brains behind Gordon. He's certainly much more confident than Gordon Brown, from everything for splitting up the Bank of England, he wrote a paper in 1994, to this excessive borrowing which they committed, which meant when the bankers tried to wreck the economy in 2007-9, they were already in a bad place. They had a structural deficit, nothing to do with the cycle and the recession of 2-3, economists disagree, 4%, which has enabled Cameron to do all that riff we heard a moment ago, which raises questions of its own. Secondly, his temperament. He could pick a fight in a room on his own, Ed Balls. And thirdly, the big one is loyalty. All the stories I've heard in the last week about, you know, Ed Balls, Damien McBride, Gordon Brown stitching up loyal acolytes like Douglas Alexander and what was that chap called?
Spencer.
That's the one, you see, just have to lead the witness, you know, turning on them when things go wrong. It's bothering. I wish him well. He's got a great opportunity, but he's got to master himself.
Well, the extraordinary thing is that sort of Ed Miliband has now found another older brother. I mean, he had Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown went away. He had his own brother. He went away.
He was driven away. He was murdered.
Murdered. Well, now he's got Ed Balls. There always seems to be a slightly dominant figure that we spend our time working out the relationship between them. But I mean, just judge Ed Balls, you know, we can look at the last decade, we can also look at the last week. I think he's done very well.
So, I mean, do you think he had an easy set of cards to play, Julian? I mean,
he had an easy set of cards he could have played badly, and he didn't. He didn't just leap in and say, this is a double dip, everything's a catastrophe. He put the focus onto a talk of growth. He picked up on what Richard Lambert said. He went for the government's vulnerabilities. He didn't just look like he was happy that things are going wrong for the country. And the danger for Labour is it looks like the party that wants everything to go wrong for Britain. It's got to look like it's got a positive agenda, and that's the thing he started to build.
He does at least have a clear narrative. You have now at least two clear competing narratives on the economy. You have essentially Ed Balls saying everything was going brilliantly while Labour was in charge, and it's only started to go downhill when the Conservatives took over, which is questionable, but it's a clear line of argument. And then you have in reverse the Cameron argument, which is we were about to be bankrupt and we were fishing down the sofa for the last sort of couple of tuppences, and then thankfully we rode in and saved the day.
But now, both those narratives are false, Gabby, aren't they?
Both those narratives
fundamentally
are false.
False.
Both those narratives are false, but at least now you have what you had previously was a clear Conservative narrative, and I don't know what the Labour narrative was before that.
I mean, that sounds like
it would
make...
Labour narrative was cut the deficit more slowly, cut it by half by 2015. Government came in and said, Greek sovereign debt crisis, the markets will blow us away if we don't act. But on day one,
that was the
proposition was...
The post-election Labour narrative on the economy just disappeared in a puff of smoke.
Well, they had 6 months electing a leader.
And they also had to wait and see, didn't they, whether it looked like the economy was still in the doldrums or was going to pick up pretty fast. But Gabby, do you think... I mean, you've said there's two... stories there on the economy. Maybe they're both rubbish, but maybe they make politics more interesting for us, those of us who look at it from the outside, in that there's a sort of choice there now. But who do you think is likely to come out best? Which one's going to get through to the public better of those two stories? It was all wonderful before, or it's all going to be okay in the future?
The trouble with the Labour narrative is that convincing people that everything was fantastic under Gordon Brown doesn't necessarily fit well with a populace that didn't vote for Gordon Brown. But on the other hand, Labour's advantage is sort of the fading of time. As things go on, he'll be banking on the fact that people may sort of forget how much they dislike Gordon Brown, may have whole new reasons to dislike David Cameron. There's nothing like losing your job to make you feel that the government may not be operating in tip-top conditions. So they'll be sort of hoping that memories fade and that anger that this government takes over sufficiently that you forget your anger at the previous government.
Yeah, the winning narrative, I mean, it's not about narratives, it's about facts. The winning narrative will be the side that shows the evidence is going its way. And if recession is confirmed and the economy doesn't grow and unemployment soars, people will listen to Labour. And if it doesn't, they'll listen to the coalition. And we don't know yet which one's going to be right.
In reality, it'll be messy. It'll be a bit of both. Unemployment will rise. Gross will falter back. It will teeter along the bottom. Inflation higher than it ought to be. Unemployment higher than it ought to be. Not enough growth. Richard Lambert's point, they've been good at cutting, but they've not been good at projecting a growth narrative. They allegedly had a white paper, which was so awful in draft form, on growth. They had to ditch it.
The whole thing.
And that's, again, why Lambert lambasted them. It says it's got to come from the private sector. It's got to come from trade. You're not doing enough about
it. Lambert's speech was so important. But it is easy for people to say we need a growth strategy, as though it's just a thing you can go to the shop and buy, and it's all spelled out. I think politics has got a long way to go to work out what it means by growth. Quite a lot of Labour talk of growth strategy is really still a commitment to more state spending on things like welfare. It isn't necessarily about growing the private sector.
It's about growing skills and education. Sorry, Gabby, there. But, the fact is they've cut the student tuition budget, all sorts of things which are destructive to what we call the supply side of the economy.
We can debate that, Mike, and some of that's true. But the fundamental thing is it's very tempting for many people on the left to use the word growth or investment. They always try and find words to disguise what is actually taxation spending.
It's also, I think, you need to look also at what kind of growth, which sounds like it's splitting hairs.
Yes.
But you have a prospect now of what David Miliband always used to call joyless growth, which is exactly the sort of thing that sounds like David Miliband would say, but which is essentially a phenomenon where GDP is growing, but a large section of the population doesn't feel as if its prospects are improving. And actually, you had that. Some of the work now being done on the famous squeezed middle voter suggests you had that even during the height of the Labour boom years. You had a large portion of low and middle earners whose wages actually weren't rising and who were flatlining even in the good times. And your worry now is about a future where GDP is rising, but because of public service cuts, because job, people don't feel as if it's getting better.
Well, Mervyn King, let's not leave him out, and made a miserable speech this week in which he said he wasn't going to raise interest rates, but that the real wages would fall for the sixth year running by 2011-12. That's awful stuff for the people Gabby's talking about.
Well, there's lots more on Labour, the Tories and the economy at guardian.co.uk/politics. But now on to what's been a touchstone issue for the Liberal Democrats, which is the control orders that the last Labour government brought into being to detain suspects who were accused of serious terrorism offences, but for one reason or another could not be properly brought to book. The announcement came yesterday, and earlier on this morning I spoke to Shami Chakrabarty of Liberty, who's been a long-time campaigner against these extraordinary orders.
There is a lot to welcome in yesterday's review. Blanket stop and search powers that have been so abused in recent years to the detriment of peace protesters and young black men are to be tightened up. You know, we'll look closely at the detail, but that is an important bit of progress. The powers to snoop on people that were passed in the name of terrorism and serious crime that have been abused by local councils are going to be subject to much greater scrutiny and magistrate's warrant. That is very positive as well.
And so on that touchstone issue of control orders that the Liberal Democrats had promised they would abolish, is it just a rebranding and is it therefore a sellout?
I want to be absolutely clear about this. Control orders are here to stay if the proposals as announced yesterday go through. We're incredibly disappointed. This was the worst legislative legacy of the war on terror. There were terrible things that happened, many of them exposed by The Guardian, like torture and so on. But in terms of the statute book, the worst legacy of the war on terror was endless punishment without charge or trial, control orders. And I think it's, if you read the papers and listen to the commentators across politics today, you will see that these have been diluted to some extent, but the basic principle, the basic process, which is this is executive order, this is not linked to the criminal justice system, it's secret intelligence that you will never be able to challenge, serious restrictions on your liberty, overnight curfews, electronic tags, you know, pretty undignified to have to wear an electronic tag and you've never been arrested, charged or tried.
And what would you say to people, and there'll be quite a lot of them in the House of Commons, who say this affects 6 or 7 people or something, or maybe even fewer than that, who it affects to the full extent, and so it's not a big issue for Britain?
Well, I would say that, as with all bad laws, it's capable of affecting a small number of people today, but in the future, in decades or hundreds of years, it could be used against a greater number of people. That's the first point. I would also say that this symbol of injustice, as with internment in Belmarsh prison before it, or indeed internment in Northern Ireland, is a recruiting sergeant from terrorism. It is a hackneyed phrase, it is a cliche, but it is true. And such iconic symbols of justice have been one of the most counterproductive aspects of the misnamed war on terror.
Gabby, listening to Shami there, although they fudged this core issue of control orders, the coalition, there's plenty to welcome, you know, the reduction in the period for which people can be held without charge, the easing of the stop and search. Do you think that the Liberal Democrats will be more focused on the fact that they've changed the tide of security and liberty in Britain rather than that they've didn't get what they wanted in this one?
This is Theresa May's argument that you have to see it in the round, that the it was kind of fetishised control orders at the expense of overlooking a whole range of other things that were being done on national security. And, you know, to a certain extent, that's true. But the trouble is, outside Parliament, it's going to look, these changes are quite technical. They're going to look like kind of tweaking and fine-tuning a surveillance state rather than a complete overhaul of it. And I think we're seeing here the same phenomenon as with tuition fees, that the Liberal Democrats, somewhat overpromised in opposition, are not able to deliver that in government. And look again as if they've fallen into the trap of, it's a classic opposition thing to do, is to talk about, you know, how the government has become overmighty and obsessed with security and you know, trampling all over our civil liberties, and brackets, if we were in, it would be very different. And it's quite hard to deliver on that once you're actually in government, responsible for national security, and will be the person at whom all the fingers are pointing, you know, if Heathrow gets blown up.
But, I mean, Gillian, it's not really like top-up fees, is it, in the sense that there they said we'll get rid of top-up fees and ended up tripling them. Here they've got at least halfway.
Yeah, the manifesto commitment was pretty limited. It said that they'd end house arrest, and I think Clegg can argue fairly that he has. I think it's a very good package. I recommend people read Ken McDonald's report, which, quite bizarrely, the government issued its own report and then issued its own official critique of what it was doing. And his report, which is clearly written...
There's liberalism for you,
yeah,
Julian.
It's beautiful. It's as diverse as The Guardian. And it's a good document, and he more or less approves of what the government is going to do. He thinks that many of the most serious abuses of power are going to be corrected. And on control orders, the great struggle everybody has is how do you prosecute people and how do you gather evidence against people while stopping them doing things that the security services think might cause mass harm. And that balance went the wrong way under the last government. I'm not sure it's quite right under this government either, but more effort needs to be done on prosecution, and that is the thing that Liberty is complaining about. Otherwise, I think it's a good package. I mean, and just in terms of the tuition fees equivalent, the difference with tuition fees is that lots and lots of voters got very upset by it. On control orders, most voters think they're brilliant and would like more of them. So the danger for the government is not going to be the people are marching in the streets saying get rid of them entirely, or at least not very many people.
They'd like you under one, Julian, if they read your stuff, most of those
absolutely.
Voters, I suspect. You always respect people who defend liberty because, as Shami Chakrabarty said there, you have to protect it all the time. It's a continuous battle. That said, there is a real problem here. The police and the Home Office don't create control orders and Parliament enact them in order to make themselves unpopular. And judges get a bit of a free kick on this. But the better way of making that point is simply to say Barack Obama, with a Democratic-controlled Congress, promised to close Guantanamo Bay, a far more egregious abuse of civil rights, liberty and the American Constitution than anything that's happened here, and has been unable to do so because there is a core problem about people you can neither prosecute for assorted reasons nor entirely take your eye off in the community. It's a dreadful, dreadful, depressing business. They did manage to convict and send to jail for life in the US a detainee who had been picked up in connection with the Kenyan bombing of the US embassy, which killed 111 Africans 15 years ago. They made slight progress this week. Let's not be too gloomy.
I mean, it's interesting. It really is only in terms of who you need this full whack curfew thing for. It's two or three people we're talking about, not even the eight that gets bandied around. And
some of the terms are going to be greatly improved. I mean, the sort of really horrific things about control orders, like forced relocation, aren't going to be there. They'll be subject to a maximum of 2 years, which doesn't exist at the moment. There is one thing I think the government should change. At the moment, control orders have to be renewed by Parliament, and indeed they're about to be renewed by Parliament for the rest of the year. This new law proposal is to be permanent, and I don't see why they shouldn't be a regular scrutiny. If the justification is this is an extreme emergency power, not part of the normal legal system, I think it should be renewed regularly by Parliament and not just put straight on the statute book forever.
Mike, would you expect we'll get a crunch point in Parliament, you know, in terms of either a detail like that or this detailed thing about making sure it's somehow built into the prosecution process?
Well, Julian's right to say read the document, the devil is in the detail. I hadn't picked up the point that it's going to be permanent. He's already made the valid point that, unlike tuition fees, this does not have an enormous constituency of voters of any party saying this is a dreadful thing, we must stop it immediately. You have particular constituencies, High Court judges, Shami Chakrabarty, and fastidious people who worry more about liberty than they do about security.
You're quite right that it's not a majority issue.
Yeah,
and it's not something besides elections. It's quite important symbolically to Liberal Democrats.
To some of them.
But do you think, Gabby, I mean, last week, just to put this in context, we had Nick Cohen and Polly Toynbee sat here, both of whom were snorting with derision at every suggestion that the Liberal Democrats were achieving anything at all in government.
Why am I not surprised to hear that?
Well, and
what a delight.
But is this a little turning of the corner? You know, there's something here they can point to that has come out differently from how it would have come out, this package as a whole, if they
it's
weren't
It's unfair
there.
To say. I mean, there is a very sort of fashionable narrative that the Liberal Democrats have achieved nothing except for sort of ministerial limos, and that's not fair or true. The trouble is that because of the prevailing, it seems as if an idea of Nick Clegg is fixed in people's minds. It'll be very hard to change, that he's some sort of, you know, window dressing fig leaf puppet of the administration, and that anything that they then achieve becomes sort of devalued by. I mean, for instance, a week or two ago, there was the announcement on shared paternity leave, which was a very big sort of personal thing for Nick Clegg, and it sort of drowned, sank without trace, almost because he's associated with it. So there is a great problem for them in being able to sort of trumpet their achievements, because it always looks when they do sort of achieve something the government wouldn't otherwise have done, it looks as if it's a sort of sop given to him by David Cameron, a sort of a paternal pat on the head, you know, and there's something for you. And that doesn't make you look great either. But the trouble is, when he starts, you know, he announced a week or two ago that he was going to pick more fights with the sort of conservative side of the commission and be more open about disagreement. And that looks almost as bad, because it looks like a trumped-up argument. Right, I've decided I'm going to pick a very stern fight with you, David Cameron. I'm going to warn you a week in advance, and then I'm going to pick a very stern fight, which I'm going to lose.
Julian, he was up a little bit, wasn't he, in your poll this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be said, we haven't had enough polls, that the Lib Dem implosion has bottomed out. I don't think there's a Lib Dem recovery. Our poll had them on 15, up a couple of points, but that's just bouncing around. And that's at the top end of where other pollsters are. YouGov had them on 11, which is a bit better than the 7 they had not long ago. So Nick Clegg's sort of, I think his feeling is, phew, maybe it's not going to get any worse, except it probably will if the economy keeps getting nasty. I mean, it is worth just remembering, as Gabby was saying, that dividends do at times make a difference. And this package is hugely different to what we would have had from Michael Howard, for instance, as Home Secretary, which was quite possible had the Lib Dems not entered coalition talks.
It's a good point that I would only say Nick Clegg has an unfortunate manner. He sounds rather virtuous and humourless and a bit priggish on a bad day. He tries to do too much. You pick that up in Whitehall. He's made about 6 different speeches in the last week. He says the constitutional reforms are the biggest since the 1832 Reform Act, second reading debate. Then he goes away and is not seen on the bill again. And he hasn't got the structure right. Some people say he hasn't got a big enough office, as well as trying to do too much. But he'll learn. He's learning on the job. He didn't expect it. That's why he made all those silly promises.
Well, let's leave the parochial problems of the Westminster parish pump there for a minute and zoom across the Atlantic to where President Obama in the House of Representatives gave his State of the Union address. And in it, he drew a parallel with a time about 50 years ago when it looked like America might just be about to slip behind the Soviets in the space race.
A half a century ago, when the Soviets beat us into space with the launch of a satellite called Sputnik, we had no idea how we would beat them to the moon. The science wasn't even there yet. NASA didn't exist. But after investing in better research and education, we didn't just surpass the Soviets. We unleashed a wave of innovation that created new industries and millions of new jobs. This is our generation's Sputnik moment. 2 years ago, I said that we needed to reach a level of research and development we haven't seen since the height of the space race. And in a few weeks, I will be sending a budget to Congress that helps us meet that goal. We'll invest in biomedical research, information technology, and especially clean energy technology. An investment that will strengthen our security, protect our planet, and create countless new jobs for our people.
Well, Mike, coalitions might not be flavour of the month as they were last summer here at the moment, but he's sort of doing the equivalent of coalition building over there, isn't he?
Yeah, he's finally getting back into the game, and liberal folk around the world, which even includes diehard old reactionaries like me, want him to get back in the game. The Republican Party is in terrible shape with a vicious and self-destructive Tea Party flank, which was evident again in Congress this week. They made their own separate speech in reply, pretty ghastly, and some really dumb economic ideas. So you want Obama to do well. And that, I thought, as with Tucson the other day after the shooting of the Congresswoman, that was Obama on top of his game, the Sputnik moment. I was 11 when the Sputnik went up. I'm going to do an imitation. Beep, beep, beep. It went around the world about 180 miles out. My God, it was a moment. And central state planning had not been wholly discredited then. People like Dennis Healy, whom I know you heard in a private meeting during the week, reminiscing, they were all up for that kind of stuff in the late 50s. The Americans were scared, but they bounced back. They've done it since. They did it after the OPEC crash. They did it at various points where OPEC crash, the OPEC oil rise, various points when they've been written off in the last 50 years. They come back harder this time. Up against China.
It's a bit fuzzy what the Sputnik moment was this time, though, wasn't it? There's no equivalent of a satellite catching everyone's imagination.
No, he said it. It's about less dramatic things, sorry, but it's about biotech and energy-efficient
green
industries, the sort of thing which Richard Lambert was talking about,
yeah,
for Britain.
Well, what it's really about is a threat to superpower status, isn't it? I mean, that's what it was.
It's more than that. It's partly
Sputnik
that.
It wasn't just about space. It was about America's idea of itself as, you know, a leading power and as a conquering power.
But they have crap infrastructure, Gabby.
China's
it's horrible.
Doing the same thing now.
Well, the problem, it was a wonderful speech in a way, and it's very good to have Obama back, and everybody should hope that he wins the next American election. But he does have a problem, which is he's going around promising these things, which are very expensive, and he doesn't have any money. The US budget deficit's about to be at a record. Congress is not
9.8%.
Going to be, Congress is not going to be sympathetic to expansionism, and wise people are beginning to warn, including IMF, beginning to warn, you know, America has to watch out. It can't just keep spending forever.
It's also not clear that it's about money in this case. I mean, the space race was relatively straightforward. You pour more money into space technology, you do better. If the threat from China, which seems to be what the speech is spelling out, is really one of education, is really one of sort of competition, competition for graduate jobs is really sort of what's dominating Davos at the moment, is sort of fear of the East rising and the West in terminal decline. Well, that's not just about spend on education. That's about all sorts of things. It's a demographic and a cultural challenge as well as a financial challenge.
And it connects with the sort of craze that seems to be going around the American Chatterati at the moment, which is Chinese supermums. And
the tiger mother thing.
The tiger mother is all over the New Yorker this week.
Do they have tiger mothers in Oxfordshire, Gabby? I bet they do.
Obviously, I am a tiger mother. No, I'm not. I'm a slummy mother.
I can hear the piano practice already.
Sadly, I failed to teach my son violin at the age of 6 months, so I've failed already. But buried within that tiger mother thing is...
He's a neat already.
Chinese parenting is better than American parenting, and that American parenting has got somehow slack, which ties into this more general fear, you know, that America has become kind of fat and lazy and faintly decadent.
Yes.
And, you know, the industrious Chinese are about to take over the world. It'd be interesting. I mean, I don't think this was one of Obama's finest speeches, I have to say. It didn't quite hang together. The rhetoric didn't quite hang together with the argument. And it does make you think, do we look back and say that whether or not through any fault of his own or whether just sort of an accident in history that Obama goes down as the president who presided over America's decline as a superpower?
Nah.
There's certainly a gap between the rhetoric and the argument. I mean, when he stood up and said, as he has to with this new Republican Congress, I can tell you today that federal spending is going to be smaller in the economy than it has at any time since President Eisenhower's day, at the same time as having all these ambitions. Mike, there is a tension there, isn't there?
Yes, of course, and it's been picked up, all the investment stuff which Gabby mentioned, and tax reform, which is expensive, and you have a countervailing force that some of the they talk about shrinking the government, the Republicans, but George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., Ronald Reagan all talked about that, but they spent like drunken sailors. It was Bill Clinton's man, who's recently been restored to office, by the way, who shrunk the budget deficit very close indeed, forgotten his name, but he's back in office with a much harder task. Yeah, it's full of contradictions. But those Republicans know that their states and their cities are close to bankruptcy in many cases, and therefore they will need federal money to sort of tide them over. And again, it's a question of moving in the right direction in a convincing way at a speed which is appropriate to the larger, fragile nature of the macro economy, which is Keynesian talk. But this week, John Maynard Keynes scored 3 goals on Monday against the coalition. So I'm sticking to my position on that. You've got to move carefully, but you've got to have a coherent plan. And the political will, very difficult in America, which has a gridlocked political system, Congress versus the White House. Voters like that, but then they don't like government in America. Scary stuff.
And what hasn't been unpictured is the impact on other areas of spending. If you're saying 3-year freeze on public spending, but presumably we're spending more on education and science to combat the Sputnik moment, then that inevitably implies cuts elsewhere, just as here, ring fencing, health and DFID, you know, implied deeper cuts elsewhere.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. I'd like to thank all of our guests, so Julian Glover, Michael White and Gabby Hinsliff, and the producer, who is Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks to all of you for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.